Thank you so much for coming. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Tova Gutenberg, and we have had the pleasure of listening to Rabbi Dr. Nathan Lopez Cardozo over Shabbat down in the Or Chaim area, and today in Zichron Yisrael, which is my shul. We have brought in Dr. Rabbi Cardozo in commemoration of the yahrzeits of our parents, my brothers, Rabbis Jay and Maury Kelman in the back, and myself. It is tomorrow going to be the sixth yahrzeit for our father, Rabbi Kelman, Joseph Kelman, and the 16th yahrzeit of our mother was this past week. It's very fitting that we commemorate their yahrzeits by sponsoring learning in their memory. This is what they wanted, and this is what is very appropriate for them as well. And we look forward to hearing from Rabbi Cardozo. He is a creative and original thinker. For those of you who have not had the opportunity, I think there are copies of his short autobiography, which if you read it, you will find it to be very fascinating. Rabbi Cardozo was born in Amsterdam and has been living in Israel for close to 40 years. He has a PhD in philosophy. He has taught in various yeshivot over the years. He spent 12 years in Gateshead, yeshiva in England, and now in Israel. He is running his own Beit Midrash, and which he may or may not tell you a little bit about. But anyways, we look forward to hearing from him this morning, and thank you again for coming.
Good morning, everybody. Shavua Tov. It's a great privilege to be able to speak here to you, and specifically because of the yahrzeit of the parents of family Kelman. And I thank especially Rabbi Jay Kelman and his wife for inviting me and having such a beautiful time at your home. Thank you so much for that. I just want to mention, as was mentioned before, there are autobiographies of mine. I don't know exactly where they are, but somewhere in the back. So please take, no charge. And the second thing I just want to mention is that if you are interested in receiving my weekly thought to ponder via internet, also free of charge, then please, over here are pages where you just fill in your name, and be very careful to fill in your email properly, because every dot counts. Friends, I want to speak about a very, very important, serious topic, which I'm sure many of you have been thinking about, discussing, arguing about, and it is something which is very close to me personally, living in Israel for about 40 years, being deeply involved in Jewish education throughout all sorts of different stages. I run a small academy on Jewish and secular philosophy in Israel, where we try to deal with new approaches to the halakha, new approaches to Jewish thinking, trying to move things forward, to get the Jewish tradition out of a lot of stagnation in which it finds itself at this moment. I'm sure you're aware of that. And one of the biggest and most important issues is the question about the status of halakha today and the way in which it is used by famous people, not so famous people, in ways which are quite disturbing, to say it nicely. Things happen in the name of halakha. I do not know to what extent this is true about Toronto, but I speak first and foremost about Jerusalem and about Israel in general, where things are done in the name of the halakha, justified by the halakha, which are from a moral perspective very problematic, to say the least. And making a very bad impression about this beautiful tradition called the halakha. Let's be clear. My position, and I suppose many of you as well, is that the halakha is no doubt the center of Jewish tradition. There is no Jewish tradition without Jewish law, without halakha. But when it gets compromised and when things are done in its name, then it loses much of its greatness, of its beauty, of its music, and it becomes something quite different from what it should really be. To me, I've written about that in great length in my autobiography, halakha is some kind of a musical note which moves us around in this world by playing our music on an instrument, a violin, which I call the halakha, where many different sounds can come about depending on how you play the violin, many opportunities, many interpretations possible. And one of the biggest and most important functions of the halakha is basically to protest and to disturb. Halakha is there basically to make us aware that we should not take life for granted. When it interferes in nearly everything and anything we do, which it does, and some of us get a little nervous because of it, the truth about it is that this is the only way how we can really, as Jews, understand that life is a complete surprise and an enormous amazement. The very fact that we are able to live, that we can do what we do, that we think what we think, are fascinating concepts, and no scientist in the world will ever be able to explain this. Science is great, beautiful, extremely important, but it is limited. And sometimes you need another discipline, another way of thinking to move in to try to understand that life is much larger than what we learn in school or what the law is able to tell us. And halakha has a very important part in this. But somehow it got lost. Somehow it became trivial. It does not disturb us anymore. It doesn't say, wake up. Be aware that this is a very unusual place, this world. And we as the Jews are a very special and unique people. We are around 4,000 years about. We have done the most incredible things throughout history. We have produced the greatest of people till this day. If you get, as I do every year, a Nobel Prize list of all the people who have received the Nobel Prize this year, again, the amount of Jewish names is out of all proportion. We are also people who irritate a lot. We irritate the world. The state of Israel irritates the world because whenever something goes wrong over there, it's blown out of all proportion. When our soldiers do their utmost best not to hurt our enemies' children, this is not at all appreciated. And one of the reasons behind that is because there's a lot of kin'ah v'sin'ah. There is a lot of jealousy about our successes. But we paid a very heavy price for making these successes possible. And much goes back to the original concept which we call Torah, Jewish tradition, our masoret. All these matters play a role in this, and it is hard for the world sometimes to be able to deal with that and understand that there is something very unique about the Jewish tradition. The problem stays when Jews no longer see this themselves, when they somehow become mediocre in the way how they deal with their religious and halachic lives. And it gets worse the moment that the color is taken out of the Jewish tradition and it becomes flat, it becomes black-white, it no longer does what it should be doing, and that is to move us forward, to put life into the place, and to make it very much a living organism which moves us in the directions we need to go. In fact, to be quite honest, and I will give you some examples in a moment, I'm sometimes very embarrassed by the way in which the halakha has been used. And that's not only by people who are the lay people, as we call them, the lay religious people, but it also happens with my own colleagues, and I say this with the greatest amount of respect, when they somehow make use of halakha in ways which I doubt very much is the authentic understanding of what this halakha should be. Now, I give you some examples here which you all know about. Quite a few years ago, somebody by the name of Yigal Amir murdered Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. This is quite a long time ago, but it is still very much with us today in Israel. I served myself in the Israeli army, and I know quite well what impression that made at the time. It was terrible. But the most remarkable and the most disturbing thing was that Yigal Amir was a religious Jew, or is a religious Jew today in jail, and used halachic arguments to make the point that what he did by killing Yitzhak Rabin was actually correct, was the right thing to do. He used, I shall not go into all the halachic reflections and ideas about that, but he basically was saying that Yitzhak Rabin was chayav mita, he was liable of death penalty, because he was a moiser, as it is normally called in the Ashkenazi pronunciation, or a rodev, somebody who puts the Jewish community into danger. Yitzhak Rabin at the time was trying very hard to make peace with our enemies, and he felt, Yigal Amir felt, that this was the wrong thing to do by all means. It would bring the whole of the state of Israel into the greatest amount of danger, and therefore, in according to halakha, Yigal Amir believed that basically Yitzhak Rabin was liable of death penalty, and he took the law in his own hand, and that's what he did. There's another case, I think it was earlier, Baruch Goldstein, who killed a whole lot of Arabs in a mosque at the time, and also used the same argument that this was the correct thing to do. He was a doctor, and he used again the halakha to justify this. And there were even rabbis afterwards who are great Talmudic scholars who justified this, basically said that what he did was right. Then there are what in English I think you call price tags. Every time again there are all sort of attacks done on the Arab community. Not that we have an easy relationship with the Palestinian Authority, and there's many terrible things coming from that part of the world towards Israel. But price tags is basically taking revenge on Arabs who are innocent. But it is done in the name of the halakha. Some years ago in Israel, a book was published, which at the time got a lot of attention in the Israeli media, and that book was called, or is called, Torat HaMelech. This is a very disturbing book written by several rabbis who have tremendous Talmudic knowledge, who were basically saying that if a Jew feels that a non-Jew in Israel is a possible danger to an Israeli or to an Israeli Jew, you can take the law into your own hands and kill the person. You don't even have to take him to court or anything like that. He's dangerous. You can get him out of the way. And they used all sort of very important authorities within Jewish law, including Maimonides and earlier and later authorities, to make that particular point. The book became such a scandal at the time that it was the government interfered and took it off from the bookshelves, and now you can only get it in the black market, and obviously that always means that more copies have been sold. Very disturbing. Written by people who know what they are speaking about. These are not ignorant people. These are people who know quite well what they are doing over there. There was a psak din some years ago by somebody who later became a candidate to become the chief rabbi of Israel, and Baruch Hashem, he did not become so, who was of the opinion that it was absolutely forbidden to rent a house to an Arab. I'm not going to throw here into the details, I'm not saying that this is out. Some kind of foundation, dangers involved and things like that in neighborhoods. But the truth about it is, it was again very bad. And I mentioned something else, and I do this with the greatest amount of respect, and do not misunderstand me. The great Posek, Sephardi Posek in Israel, as you all know, who died not so long ago, Rav Obadia Yosef, who has done tremendous work when it comes to making women able to remarry again after they lost their husbands or their husbands disappeared, whatever it was, in war, and he was no doubt a remarkable and unbelievable encyclopedic mind. But when you sometimes heard him on the radio, Motzei Shabbat, he used to speak in Israel on the radio when he gave these drashot, he said the most terrible things about non-Jews, about Arabs, and about other things, and you wondered how it is possible that the same man who has done so much great stuff within the halachic world and helping so much people at the same time was saying such foolish things. Let's be quite honest. That's what it was. We never have understood how that actually worked with him. Anyway, the big problem here is this. I have tried on several occasions to speak to these people, or people who are basically supporting these people who have been writing, saying, or doing these things. And when you get in an argument with them, they will pull out an enormous amount of Jewish knowledge to prove that they are right. They do this with knowledge. They will quote you a Rambam here and a Shulchan Aruch there and a piece of Gemara there. They will put the whole thing on the table and then they say to me, Rabbi Cardozo, what do you want? I'm just following Jewish law. If you don't like it, that's one thing, but don't tell me that I'm doing something against the halakha. The whole literature is behind me, is basically supporting me. So what do you want from me? And indeed, they do this very, very well. And in the same time, and that's the point which I'm going to make, is I'm absolutely sure that what they have been doing in the name of these works, whether it is Maimonides or Rabbi Yosef Karo or anybody else, they completely missed the point. That is, I don't have as many sources behind me, my point of view, where I believe strongly that they made an enormous mistake, to say the least. And they have more sources than I have, and still, I'm absolutely convinced that they're wrong. That they are not a little wrong, but they are terribly wrong, and that I am terribly right about this. And I don't say this out of any arrogance, but because I think my reading of the Jewish tradition is better than theirs. Also, I know all the sources which they mentioned to me, and it doesn't make any impression on me. It doesn't convince me at all, because I think that they are misreading the whole of the Jewish tradition. I'm going to show you, by way of some Talmudic observations, basically stories, one or two stories, where the problem lies, and I will try to build this out. And what I'm going to say over here, be aware that this is a new way of looking to all this. I believe it is really very old, but I haven't seen anybody really discussing this properly. The Gemara in Yoma, in Chaf Beit 22a, tells a remarkable story about a case where young Kohanim, in the days of the Beit HaMikdash, in the days of the temple, used to run up to the Mizbeach. To the Mizbeach is the altar standing at the middle of the Mishkan and later of the temple. And they used to run up there because it was a mitzvah, it was a great mitzvah, to remove the ashes on top of the Mizbeach from the Mizbeach. That's a mitzvah in itself, and obviously only Kohanim are allowed to do that. And therefore it says the following story, there are actually two stories. Ma'aseh shehayu shneihem shavim. There were young Kohanim running as fast as possible to the top of the Mizbeach, because whoever was there first had the mitzvah of removing the ashes from the Mizbeach. And therefore, everybody tried to get hold onto that mitzvah. So they run. V'ratzim ve'olim ba'kevesh. They went up to the ramp. And what happened was, v'dachaf echad mehin et chaviro. And what happens was that because one wanted to be there first, he gave a push to the other one, and the other one fell on the floor so that he would not be there first. And he chapt, as we say in Yiddish, he took the mitzvah and walked away with it. V'kevan, says the Talmud, she'ra'ur beidin, when the beidin, the rabbinical court of this day, saw this, that people were using means which were not very nice, they said, this will bring things into sakana, people get hurt while they're trying very hard to do this mitzvah, and therefore they made a decree and said that from now on the Kohanim should get selected for this service. Beforehand they would be appointed for it, and there was no running anymore onto the Mizbeach to get there first. But then the Gemara a little later tells us in 23a in Yoma a terrible incident which is shocking, and it is very interesting that the Talmud tells this story. And that is that again some Kohanim, probably earlier than that, were running onto the ramp of the Mizbeach, and when one saw that the other one was getting closer and was faster than himself, he took a knife and put a knife into the body of the other fellow and killed him. Basically killed him. And when the child was lying, and these are young people, they were lying on the floor, Rabbi Tzadok, says the Talmud, came up and says, "Oh, brothers, house of Israel, see what happens here right in the Beit HaMikdash, that people are murdering other people in the name of wanting to do a mitzvah." In the name of wanting to do the mitzvah, and the Talmud tells very beautifully that all the people started to cry, they were terribly upset that happened. But here the continuation of this story. Ba aviv shel tinok. The child of, or better, the father of this child who was killed, came umatzu'u keshehu mefarpir. And he found that his child had not yet completely died. He was on his way out, but he was still alive at that moment. Said he, the father of this child, v'adayin benime farpir, I see that my child is still alive, v'lo nit ma'a sakin, and therefore the sakin, the knife by which he was killed, is not yet tum'ah, it is not yet impure, because he is not dead yet, and therefore if we very quickly remove the sakin, this particular knife, from his body, we are able to prevent that the sakin, which is very bad in the Beit HaMikdash, would get tum'ah. In the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, you're not allowed to have anything which is impure. So the father therefore said, let's quickly take the knife out of my child's body so that we can save the knife. Says the Talmud, Lelam decha shikasha alehem taharat kelim yoter meshfichud damim. It comes to teach you that they regarded the purity of the knife more seriously than murder. That's the criticism of the Talmud on this incident. What are your priorities here? The sakin? To keep it to make sure that it stays pure, or your own child who is dying at this very moment is mefarpir. These are the last seconds of his life, and your mind is with the sakina. Your mind is with the knife and not with your child. And the Talmud stays into an incredible bewilderment at this very moment that something like that could happen. And the question indeed is: how is this possible? How can something like that happen? In the temple, and not only in the temple, where are the priorities? I'm sure that if I would have been able to speak to this father, he would have come up with all sorts of Talmudic arguments to say that he was right. It's not possible to have any time, any tum'ah, any impurity into the temple, and therefore he felt that this was more important than anything else. But I don't have to tell you, and I don't have to explain you, there is something very wrong about this. Very, very wrong, and that's exactly what the Talmud is trying to get to when it says, in an earlier case or in a later case, that Rabbi Tzadok got up and said, you see what happened over here? The halachic system went out of order. Suddenly there are priorities made here by using all sorts of different arguments, and you can bring these arguments from many different sources to tell you that it is more important to look after the knife than to look after your child. But there's nobody in the world who will say, yes, he's right. Can I bring proof for that? I can bring this particular story to prove my point that there is something basically wrong here about the approach to what this is all about and why this happens. Now, you can come afterwards to me, and some of these rabbis would have done that in our days. They would have said, but wait a moment, let's be objective about this. If we think in pure halachic terms, the father was right. He had to make sure that this particular knife would not get tum'ah because it is a terrible isur, a prohibition within the temple. But all of you know, and I know, that the whole argument doesn't work. The only problem is that we are not aware how are we going to argue against this kind of way of thinking about what the halakha is all about. This is similar to the case of Yigal Amir, not knowing priorities. Not that I agree with Yitzhak Rabin in the way how he dealt with that problem, because perhaps I also disagree with him. But to make this into murder, to kill a man because of that, or for that reason to stand up against an Arab population which is completely innocent of what others have done in their name, no doubt. Let me show you. Very important. We have to ask here a fundamental question about the status of halakha within the Jewish tradition. True, as I said before, no doubt halakha is the ikar. It is the central piece of the Jewish tradition. Without halakha, there is no Jewish tradition. But is halakha everything and anything? Let me ask you this question. Perhaps you have thought about this. Why is it that Jewish law and the Torah, I mean by that, first of all, the 613 commandments, was actually given so late in Jewish history? It was not given to Avraham. The Torah was not given to Avram, it was not given to Yitzchak, it was not given to Yaakov, not to the 12 tribes. It took a few hundred years since Abraham, who was the first Jew, before the Torah in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu has been given at Mount Sinai. There are a few hundred years in between. And the obvious question is, but wait a moment, why then does HaKadosh Baruch Hu not give straight away the Torah to the first Jew in history, which is Abraham, a few hundred years earlier? That would have been the obvious thing, because how can you be a Jew without the Torah? But here is a Jew without the Torah. And a whole generations after generations are without Torah, till the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, and then suddenly there is a need, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides to give the Torah to Am Yisrael, to the Jewish people. What is the meaning behind that? Why is that the case? I tell you like this, and different commentators have been writing about this. If Abraham, Avraham Avinu, would have received the Torah and would have been asked to keep all the 613 commandments, or Yitzchak or Yaakov, any one of them, it would have created complete disaster. It would have been too early, and it would not have worked. Why that is? Well, there are very good reasons to say this. Because if you give a law, in this case a divine law, to anybody, if the people are not yet ready to receive it, then instead that it does any good, it can do a tremendous amount of harm. There are a few points here which need to be clarified. Number one is this. Law and life are not similar things. Law is never able, not even divine law, is ever able to cover the sum total of what life is all about. because somewhere they stand in a contradiction. The contradiction is that the law wants to put life into boxes. This belongs here. This belongs there. In this case, we do like this. In this case, we do like this. You and I know, and any judge in any American court will tell you that straight away, that it doesn't always work. And very often it does not work at all. Why? Because living circumstances often prove that the law cannot reach to every particular occasion which happens in your and my life. Life is full of contradictions, paradoxes, issues which the law can never deal with at all, because the law would become impossible to apply under those circumstances. But it means at the same time also that since life is much larger than what halakha or what law can ever be, whether it is the constitution of the American people or of Canada, or it is Israeli law, or it is even Jewish law, which is divine law in according to our tradition, it can never cover all the conditions under which we as human beings live. Law has a problem. It wants to put life in order, and life doesn't allow itself to be put in order. You know this from your experience, and I know this from my experience. It doesn't work. The law is there to put some kind of consistency in our lives, specifically when it comes to life, which we live in the public domain. The law, normally American law or Canadian law, will not interfere much in what happens in our private lives. That's our private business. Jewish law is a little different over there, because Jewish law does interfere in our private lives, but at the same time, it quite well knows, and if you look in all the responsa which have been written by the rabbis, that there are so many exceptions to the rules. There are so many circumstances which the halakha cannot even deal with by straight away put a law on top of it, and therefore there's a tremendous amount of flexibility which goes to the left and to the right and different disagreements. We have this famous statement, which I'm sure you all heard about, Elu Elu Divrei Elokim Chayim, these and those are the words of the living God, meaning to say that in God there are so many paradoxes when it comes down to what human life is all about, that there is nowhere in the world, no Shulchan Aruch, no Rambam, nobody at all, who can put that all in order. There will always be exceptions. That's number one. Number two, very important to realize, is also this. There are certain fundamental values in life which actually are prior to the law itself. You can call them built into our very souls. If you read Immanuel Kant, one of the great German philosophers at the time, he used to speak what he calls the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative is that there is, call it intuition, call it your moral voice, whatever name you want to give it. There are certain things which are built within us from the very beginning that we are born, and we know that there is a need for decency. There's a need for moral conscience to speak to us when we do something wrong, then something tells us in the back of our mind, you should not have done that. This is not law. This is what it means to be human. The human voice within man, whether you are Jewish or Gentile, it really doesn't make much of a difference. It is a certain kind of situation where the law can't get, including the halakha, Jewish law can't get there, and does not need to get there, because it is already there. It is a given. It follows from the concept within the Jewish tradition, as you all know about, that all of us, Jew and Gentile, have been created b'tzelem Elokim, in the image of God. That is to say, there are certain values which are straight away moved within our souls, within our subconscious, which are there from the very moment that we get born. They get afterwards elevated and properly applied in later days when we are more aware of it. But all of this has to do with the human spirit. Also, the other matter, which is very close to this, is the search for God, the search for religiosity. the feeling that life is holy. I can't prove you that life is holy. And there are people out in this world, very intelligent people, who will say there is nothing holy about life. We are nothing more than an animal. But many of us feel that that's not true. There is something speaking within us which tells us that human life is very specific and very unique, and we should be very careful about it. There is a feeling of rachmanut, of having mercy on your fellow man, even when you don't get anything out of it. That's what happens within the human being. And that can only come about, and these methods can only be developed when we learn life by way of experience. They are not in school books. They are not in any legal structure. They are not anywhere written down in ways that we really make proper sense of it. It is life itself which creates these experiences. Some of us have some more of it, some of us have less of it, but the fact that the life of human beings is kadosh, is holy, that there is a certain intuition telling us that there are certain things which cannot be done and other things must be done, has nothing at all to do with law. In fact, law could become extremely dangerous, because if we want to start to put everything in order and in boxes and tell us kedushah, holiness of life, applies here, but it doesn't apply there, and this particular person has lost his holiness, and therefore you're allowed to kill him. If we would start doing that, and the legal system would be able to do something like that, and that is one of the biggest worries of any judge when he sits in court. The problem is the judge in court has that when a person comes in front of him, he says to himself, you know what? The laws which I've studied for years in Harvard University don't work here. This is such a special situation over here, where also people are involved. The father has to go to jail, but there are children, there is a wife, there are also those circumstances, and we need to know all of that. There is no want in the law at all where it can cover all these particular situations. And therefore, my dear friends, when the Torah had to be given, it had to wait till these values had been growing within the human community. The feelings of intuition, that morality, the question about kedusha, about the holiness of human beings. And when that is taken together with the experience of people like Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and also people who get an experience in life, who for the first time meet God in an encounter, which also has obviously enormous implications, this is not yet the time to give the law. This is yet the time to learn life. You know how I call this? This period between Avram up till Moshe Rabbeinu, when the Torah is given, I call that the incubation time. It is the time where there is an embryonic kind of Judaism slowly getting involved, moving forwards, getting developed. The law is not there yet. The law cannot be there yet. Because if the law walks in too early, it will take over life and it will destroy that life. And therefore, the Torah is given late in Jewish history. Not to Avram, not to Yitzchak, not to Yaakov. It has to wait till Moshe Rabbeinu, because by that time, and specifically, as you all know, after the Jews have gone through the experience of Mitzrayim, of Egypt, which is perhaps the greatest learning center of the Jews for 210 or 400 years, depending on how you want to count. What happens over there is all the paradoxes, the slavery, the suffering, and so on. Out of that, a very specific nation comes to an existence, understands that there are values in life, that there is life itself, and only then it is able to say, okay, now we are ready for the law. Not a moment and not a second earlier. Nations require law. Nations need law for one good reason. In the public domain, first of all, without it, it would be a complete balagan, it would be a complete mess. But when it comes to the Jewish tradition, this is even more important, and that is the reason why the rabbis make this beautiful observation that is very deep. You all know it. Derech Eretz Kotma Latorah. First there has to be Derech Eretz, which is difficult to translate, is learning life, understanding what it means to be a human being, understanding the values which you have to live by. And after all that has been part of this incubation time and the Jews slowly pick it up and they start to understand what this is all about, at that moment when there is a moral conscience, a moral religious conscience, then the Torah can be given at Sinai and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, now you're ready for my law. You know why? Because the halacha, hear well, my dear friends, halacha is not instead of morality and of our moral conscience. It is on top of it. It builds on these values. First, we have to have the foundations. Then we can speak about all what this law, this specific law called Jewish law, Shabbat, Kashrut, whatever it is, and all the other things which go along with it. It is built on these foundations, and therefore the Jewish tradition cannot stand just on the foundations of halacha. Halacha had to come later, extremely important, giving at Sinai. I shall not go into now what halacha really means, because that in itself is quite an issue over here, but here it is. Now let me show you something very interesting. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, shehakol nehiyah bidvaro. There is an introduction written on Sefer Bereshit by one of the greatest commentators we had in modern times. In the yeshiva world, he's called the Netziv. The Netziv is in the last Rosh Yeshiva of a Voloshiner yeshiva, which was the ultimate yeshiva, highly intellectual yeshiva in the 19th century. Voloshin was afterward destroyed by the Nazis. And in this introduction, which is an introduction to Sefer Bereshit, to the first book of the Torah, short, only one page, which is extremely explosive and unbelievably beautiful. Remember, the Netziv is one of the Gedolei Hador, as they would call it today, one of the great ones. Says the Netziv the following, which is absolutely remarkable. He says, you know that in according to the Jewish tradition, there was another name for Sefer Bereshit. We didn't call it Bereshit. We called it Sefer HaYashar. Sefer HaYashar means to say a book of straightforwardness. But it's actually more than straightforwardness. It is a kind of word which says that you do more than what the law requires. Says he like this. He says, why is this Sefer called by that name, Sefer HaYashar, in old rabbinic tradition? He says, because you should know that Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, which is the story of Sefer Bereshit, they are all Yesharim. Yesharim doesn't mean to say they're straight, just like that, straightforward. But it means to say that they are more than just being tzaddikim. They're not just righteous people. They are more than righteous people. And how do we know that? Says the Netziv, I tell you why. Because the truth about it is that you see that people like Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and many people like that, when they had to deal with the wicked people among whom they lived, they dealt with them the yashrut. They dealt with them in a way that they showed their mercy, although they disagreed with their lifestyle and what they did. They had mercy on them. They understood that if they won't take that attitude towards these people, then the world will never get a better, become a better place. They had to relate to them. They were of day Avodah Zarah. They were idol worshippers. They sacrificed their children on the altars of the different kind of idols at this time. And still, says the Netziv, they went out of their way. Remember Avram Avinu when it comes to Sodom and Amorah, which are two terrible places full of wickedness. And what does he do? You all know the story. He says to God, you know, you can't do this. Very interesting. We'll come later back to this. You cannot do this. This is bad for your PR. And Avraham Avinu is not told by God, mind your own business, I decided that I'm going to destroy these stories. But God says to him, basically, yeah, you have a very good point. And in the end, they make a deal. The deal is that, okay, all the real wicked people, HaKadosh Baruch Hu still decides that they have to go, but he makes certain conditions on that, and Lot and his family somehow get saved. Very strange, because this is purely against the halacha. And I'll tell you in a moment why that is. But before I do so, when you come to Yitzchak, remember Yitzchak with all the problems which he had with the ro'im, the different people who were moving around there with their sheep, and there was kneva, there was stealing, there were all sorts of terrible things going on. And Yitzchak holds back and he's nice to these very people. Yaakov, when he has to deal with his father-in-law, Laban, you know, what an incredible story over there, Laban. And Yaakov tries his utmost best to be as nice as he can be under the circumstances. But all that, and the Netziv doesn't explain that and doesn't say a word about that, runs contrary to halacha. How do I know that? Because there's a pasuk in the Torah, in Devarim, chapter 7, which says that one should have no mercy on these people. In Hebrew we say, lo techanem. Don't show them any mercy. This is specifically speaking about the seven nations who were living in the land of Israel when Joshua entered there. And the HaKadosh Baruch already said beforehand, when you get to these people, the Hittites, the Kirkshites, and so on, these are terrible weeding. Nowhere any mercy on them, nothing to do with them. You keep away from these people by all means, and if needed, you have to destroy them as well on top of that. Lot techanem, don't show any mercy. There's no leniency here. It is a harsh statement coming from God. And interestingly enough, if you look in the Talmud, you will see that the sages later on, one has to understand why that is, didn't only apply this law to the seven nations who lived at the time. They basically applied it to all the goyim in the world, all the non-Jews in the world. Don't show them any mercy. If you hear these words which I'm saying now, we all get very upset and say, wait a moment, that's Jewish law? Lot techanem, you're not allowed to show any mercy. What am I going to do with all the nice people who are living around me here in Toronto who are fantastic non-Jews? Perhaps they are bigger tzaddikim, bigger righteous people than we are. What is the point here? Well, my dear friends, the point is this. The Netziv is making a very important statement over here. It is true that you have to be very careful in the way when you deal with wicked people. If you are too merciful on them, it may go wrong. And we Jews have often been too merciful and we paid a heavy price for that, where we didn't see the dangers coming up. But basically what he is saying is this. The fact that people are of day avodah zarah, we don't really have this today anymore in the form of idol worship, and even people who are not nice and so on, that's not what the Torah is speaking about. The Torah is speaking about two groups of people. I'm going to put that into our language of today. They didn't write in these terms, but that's what I understand it to mean. They're speaking about absolute terrorists. They speak about Nazis. They speak about people who have lost all understanding of what human life is all about and the kedusha of holiness of life is all about. They are not speaking at all about good people around in this world, of which there are, Baruch Hashem, many. It's true, we have ISIS, we have Hamas, we have also people who don't seem to have any consideration for anybody, not even on their own people. That may be that there, says the Netziv, or implies the Netziv, there is perhaps this law, don't be overly merciful to them, because on the end we may get worse than what it was before. But there is no such thing as suddenly saying, since there is a law in the Bible which says you shall not have any mercy on these people, that we put this in a box and we say this is therefore to be applied on everybody and anybody, without realizing at the same time that life doesn't work like that at all. The Meiri, one of the great, Menachem Meiri, one of the great earlier commentators on the Talmud, one of the most outstanding and brilliant people, keeps on telling us that all these laws, like don't have mercy, that applied only to the Nazis of these days. That applied really to people who were bad in every sense of the word, and if you would give in to them, you would indeed pay a heavy price. And therefore, my point is this. You have to realize all men are created in the image of God. Jew, non-Jew, whatever skin of color of their skin, that's what it is. However, there are exceptions where people become dangerous. We will have to put them in jail. We have to do also things by them, otherwise they can take over the world. And we see today indeed that these dangers exist. But what the Netziv, in my opinion, is trying to get to is this. He warns the world of halacha. He says, don't just come and apply an halacha without understanding the conditions under which this particular thing takes place. And you know how you can make sure that you are not going to make that mistake? Read and study Sefer Bereshit. Why are there no laws in Genesis in the first book of the Torah? There are only three. Brit Milah, one or two more. For the rest is all narrative. Why is this so important? Because there you start to hear the value system of the Jewish tradition. There you hear about what it means to be created in the image of God. There you understand that there is much more to life than what the halakha can ever provide you with. And therefore, to turn this around a little bit different, I would argue like this. Sefer Bereshit, that's why it is so incredibly important, this work, and therefore it is the first one, is an all-around critique on the halachic system. It is basically saying, you want to apply halacha, as it was given later in the days of Moshe, first read Sefer Bereshit. First understand the values. First understand the greatness of man, the fact that man is holy, that the life of man is holy. First there are values. After that we can speak about halacha. Why? Because halacha can run wild. It can actually run wild. And Sefer Bereshit is there, the value system is there to constrain the halacha, and like the Netziv says, don't just apply it here, because you first have to learn a lot of other things before you can come to this halacha. And the question is indeed, whether or not we today understand this fact. And I include in that people who I greatly admire, and that are our poskim, our halachic decision makers today. I wonder, I can't say more than that, did they read halacha, or better, Sefer Bereshit, good enough that when later on they made declarations about the world in which we live, about our enemies, whatever it is, the Arab population, or whatever else is going on specifically in Israel, or the question about Yitzhak Rabin, or whatever it is, did you read Sefer Bereshit first? Did you hear what Avram did concerning Sodom and Amorah? What Yitzchak did, what Yaakov did for people who they completely disagreed with? Did they kill them just like that? In fact, God, or better, Avram gets into an enormous argument with God about Sodom and Amorah and says, God, I'm very sorry, I don't agree. And instead of God saying, as I said before, it's not your business, God says, it is your business. I want you to disagree with me about this particular matter, because then I know you have understood what life is all about. Then I know that you have understood what the Jewish tradition is all about. But if you're just going to put it into legal systems and you're going to overwhelm me with all sorts of halachic arguments, then you have missed the boat altogether. This is the problem. It's a problem which I think we are today very much confronted with. People have not understood yet, including some very big people. And not only Yitzhak Amir and Baruch Goldstein and people like that, but people in general have, in our Jewish religious community, we have created nearly, I would say, forgive me for saying this, a kind of avodah zarah out of halacha. We have created idol worship of the halacha. Suddenly, it is all what is there. In fact, we are now living in a period of time where when we speak about the beliefs of the Jewish tradition, I'm not speaking even out halacha, what are some rabbis doing? They want to make that in halacha as well. They want to tell you, as a halacha, you have to believe this, and as a halacha, to believe that. If you go back into the Jewish tradition, there's never anything like that. We didn't halachalize our beliefs. They were open to discussion. Yes, there were particular yesodot, as we say in Hebrew, certain foundations on which it all stood. But suddenly, everything becomes halacha. Abraham Joshua Heschel, one of the great Jewish thinkers of America, who was of a Hasidic background, used to speak about what he calls pan-halacha. Like you have pan-American, which means only America, there's nothing else anymore, but only America. So you can also have a tradition of pan-halacha. That means to say everything becomes a halachic issue and we forget about all what we have learned of what is not halachic. The Agadah, the whole mysterious and beautiful world of the music of the Jewish tradition. No, no, we want it all down here on the thing in a mathematical form. Everything has to be worked out and we don't want any doubts and we don't want any discussions anymore about it. It is destroying the Jewish tradition. I make one more comment about this, and I want you basically to go home and think a little bit more about it, and if you want, pass it on to the people who need to hear it. I give you one example, which is very disturbing in Jewish law, which I think has been completely misunderstood. But it is true that in many ways people may argue with me about this. Are you allowed to save a non-Jew on Shabbat? It's a famous question. Are you allowed to save on Shabbat the life of a non-Jew? If you look into the Codex of Jewish Law, then the answer is no, you're not allowed to do this. Truth is, to be quite honest, if you look very carefully, you can really neither save a Jew on Shabbat. Why is that? Because it seems that Shabbat belongs to one of these rules, of which we have officially three, where you better give up your life than to violate. You know them. Sexual relationships are absolutely forbidden. Avodah Zarah, idol worship. Murder. If somebody comes to me and says, I want you to murder him, otherwise I murder you, I am not allowed to murder the other person. I better get murdered myself. We call that in Hebrew, Yahareik v'lo Ya'avor. You better get killed and you don't violate the law. But that's only about three cases. But the sages say that the Shabbat was nearly as close to this as well. That Shabbat is so much a fundamental concept of the Jewish tradition and of the Jewish people and the destination and the survival of the Jewish people. If there's no Shabbat, the Jewish people would already have disappeared a long time ago. That it is a nearly a matter of sakanat nefashot, but here in the other sense of the word, and that is to say, you better don't violate Shabbat even when you have to give up your life, because if you do, you may be undermining the survival of the Jewish people. Remember this famous story, they say it in many people's names, that it was not so much that the Jews kept the Shabbat alive, but it was the Shabbat which kept the Jews alive. And there is a lot of truth to that. However, we all know quite well that you must save the life of a Jew on Shabbat. How do we know that? So that the rabbis came with a way out. They say like this, it says, V'shamru b'nei Yisrael et ha-Shabbat, the Jews should observe Shabbat, la'asot et ha-Shabbat, so that they will be able to do the Shabbat, from which they learn the following, you are only allowed to observe Shabbat in such a way that next week you are still able to keep Shabbat. If you get killed in the meantime because of it, then you're missing the boat. So they use the pasuk, a verse in the Torah itself, to prove the point. When it comes to Jews, you have to save their lives on Shabbat because make sure that next week they're still alive. But what are we going to do about non-Jews? Because they are not officially required to keep Shabbat. Some people even say that they're not allowed to keep Shabbat. I shall not go into this now. So the rabbis came up with a very strange argument. which works like this, my dear friends, which people don't understand. There's a little bit of an historical background to this. We always saved non-Jews on Shabbat. There was never a time that we actually let them die. There was only one problem. That's what the Jew did. The Jew never went to the rabbi and said, can I or can I not save the non-Jew on Shabbat? That didn't come even up to his mind at all. Obviously, this is a human being. I'm going to save him even on Shabbat. He's also a holy being. He's also B'Tselem Elohim, created in the image of God. But the rabbis had a problem, which they often have, and that is that they couldn't find somewhere a source which would justify that. Happens all the time in Jewish tradition. So what did they do? After already the people had decided that they are definitely going to save the life of a non-Jew, the rabbi said, we better find something to hold on to that we can justify that in Talmudic terms. By the way, this happens all the time in the Talmud. If you look in Tosafot, one of the major commentators on the Talmud, constantly what happens over there is that Tosafot justifies something which the Jewish community is already doing for a long, long time. And now it is a problem because we have no source for it, so we will find the source for it, even when it is far-fetched. And very often it is far-fetched. Because the intuition of the Jew was, there is no such thing as letting somebody die on Shabbat, whether he's Jew or he's a non-Jew. So the rabbis came up with the following. They said, okay, you know what we have? We have the following argument. We can say that we are allowed to survive, or better, to save the life of a non-Jew on Shabbat, mipnei ha'eva. What does that mean? It is a Talmudic expression and concept which says something like this. Since it is dangerous to let the non-Jew die on Shabbat, because if the non-Jewish world will find out that we let him die while we could have saved him, we by that bring the whole of the Jewish community in danger and we'll have anti-Semitism against us and they will start doing things against us. So therefore, we are allowed to save him on Shabbat. I don't know what you think of the argument. I get very disturbed about this argument. And I think that the sages were also very disturbed about it when they created the argument. Because the argument obviously doesn't work. It doesn't work correctly. It doesn't work morally, for one good reason. The whole argument is we save the non-Jew only because we want to save ourselves. If it's not a matter of saving ourselves, then we don't have to save the non-Jew. Imagine you are on an island and there is no non-Jew around and your friend is dying on Shabbat and you don't save him. You don't have to worry about the fact that they take revenge on you because there's nobody around and nobody will ever know about this. What are you going to do? Are you going to let him die? Nobody will think about letting the man die. Obviously, you will save him. But what the sages did, and that was the marvelous thing about it, is the following. We call that an harama, a legal fiction. It means to say, you know what? We don't want just to say, go and save their lives. Why? Because there may be occasions when we won't. When? Well, you know, I am not prepared to save the life of a terrorist who just killed my children or my grandchildren, chas v'shalom. He has lost it. I am not prepared in the Holocaust to start saving the life of a Nazi who just killed hundreds or thousands of Jews. Let him die on Shabbat. However, on the other side, I am definitely going to save everybody else. And the sages fully agreed with that. And they said, we have to save these people. The rule in general is you all save everybody. Mipnei ha'eva applies only in a case where you would have said to yourself, you know, let the Nazi die. Let Hitler in Machshavot die. I'm not going to save him on Shabbat. The only reason why perhaps we should save people like that is that if it would bring about a lot of anti-Semitism, we may have to think twice about this, purely because otherwise we may bring the whole of the Jewish community into trouble. But objectively speaking, let the terrorist die. That's what the sages had in mind. Now, obviously, and I do not deny that, there's a lot of discussion about this whole matter, how this works and when it works and so on. I shall not go into this now, and I'm definitely here biased in the sense that I'm reading it this way, And I'm not saying that also people perhaps read this in a different sense of the word, but I think that I'm closer to the truth about what the sages had in mind than some of my good friends. Now let me, for just one more moment, add one or two dimensions to this, which I think is something to think about, while no doubt one has to be very careful about it. I mentioned this yesterday also on Shabbat. There are laws in the Torah which are, no doubt, disturbing. I mentioned yesterday the mamzer law. The child pays the price for the fact that the parents had adulterous relationship. The child can't get married to everybody and is incredibly limited, and probably his life gets destroyed. That's a case where we see, if you very carefully look into the Talmud and in later authorities, is we will try everything and anything to prove that the child is not a mamzer. And we do this by arguments which are incredibly far-fetched, which really nobody believes in, and we still use them. I give you one example. I told that story yesterday as well. In Holland, from where I come, there was a case many years ago where a woman walks in, a Polish woman came to Holland after her husband, her Jewish husband, had died by drowning in a river. Had drowned in a river. There were people there who saw him being drowned, and he was dead. So she came to Holland, and she wanted to remarry, and she remarried. She had chuppa and kiddushin, as we say, by the Orthodox rabbi of the time, and she got two children. And then the following happened. The husband, the first husband, appeared. He was alive. He was alive. What now? So she understood the problems. She went to the rabbinate and said, you know, my first husband just appeared. I didn't know. Everybody told me that he was dead. And I would not have married my second husband if I would have known that. But in the meantime, I've got two children. And the rabbinate said, they're mamzerim. Because you were first married, you didn't have a get from your husband. So therefore, when you're married in adultery, a form of adultery, you couldn't help it. It's true. But after all, on the end of the day, it is what is not permitted. Your children are mamzerim. And then the following happened. There was a woman in Rotterdam who didn't like this and said, we have to find a way out of this. This woman can't help it. She did. Everything was fine. She was a religious woman herself. And the children are mamzerim. So she said to the chief rabbinate, the rabbi in Holland, she said, do you mind if I take this case to the Israeli rabbinate, which is in the days of Rav Unterman, who was one of the great chief rabbis of the earlier generation, who was in tremendous posseik, a tremendous halakha. And the chief rabbi said, fine, if we can find a way out of this, I'm the first one to, I can't see it, but let's go and speak to Rabbi Unterman. He's an ultimate posseik, a tremendous authority. So Rabbi Unterman started to investigate this and asked her hundreds of questions about here and there, what happened and so on. And then he said on the end, you know, I came to the following conclusion. Your first husband, when he married you, the ring which he gave you, when he said, Hare at mekudeshet libetawat sukedat k'moshe Yisrael, as we get married, that ring needs to be his. If it is not his, you're not married. I think the ring was not his. He was such a poor man, it couldn't be that he could have bought a ring of silver or of gold. So therefore, you were never married to the first person, to your first husband. Which means to say that when you're married to a second husband, there is no problem at all, because she was never married to the first time, so your children are not mamzerim. Then the woman said to him, but wait, there is more to the story. And Rabbi Unterman said, I don't want to listen anymore. That was the chokhmah, the greatness of this man. He said, I have heard what I want to hear. You now stop telling me more. I have now decided that the ring did not belong to this particular man at the time when he married her. How could he have known? He couldn't know. He was not there at the time. But he said possibly he was so poor that the ring could not have been him, and that's for me enough of a reason. And he said the children are not mamzerim. I know a few more cases like that. And that's the beauty of the Jewish tradition. Is it far-fetched? Yes, it is absolutely far-fetched. But there's one particular point here. This is built on Sefer Bereshit. It is built on human values. You don't hurt people if there is no need. If you find a way out, even when it is going this way and that way, and people will say, oh, it's terribly far-fetched that you do this. No, my dear friends, it's not far-fetched at all. It is exactly what the halakha is all about. It is human to the very source and the very root of it. And therefore, when we have a way to deal with it, we will find a way. There are loads of examples in Jewish tradition, by the way, where these things have happened. I finish with a fantastic midrash. And I will ask you a question on the end, and I'll let you go home and you think about it. The midrash says like this. On several occasions, Moshe Rabbeinu had a disagreement with God. When God came up and said, I want you to do this, and Moshe said, I'm not going to do this. It only happens in the Jewish tradition. In Christianity, there is no such thing. That a human being gets up and says, God, I'm very sorry, but you have it wrong. In the Talmud, there are many very famous narratives about this, beautiful narratives. So here's one. In Midrash Tanchuma, 96, chapter 96, Midrash 3, if you want to look it up. The Holy One, I translated it literally out of Hebrew. The Holy One, blessed be He, told Moshe to destroy the seven nations when they came into the land of Israel, the nations we spoke about before. But Moshe did not want to do so. He said, no, I will not do so. Should I now go and attack both those who have sinned and those who have not sinned? Their women, their children, while the man may have been wicked people, but there is more there than just the man. They're women, they're children. What am I going to do about this? Said HaKadosh Baruch Hu, hear this midrash. I told you to destroy them. And you said you won't do it. By my life, you're right. And I will give you a different law. And that is when you approach a city, then you first have to declare peace with them. And only after a lot of things have not been fulfilled, then you may attack them, but not beforehand. There are many conditions. Maimonides speaks about it in great lengths, what all these conditions are. No time to go into this now. But here we have a typical Jewish situation. God says one thing, and Moshe says another thing. And Moshe says, God, you just can't do that. Just like in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, remember? I also told you at the time, or better, Abraham told you at the time, you can't just destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and God said, actually, you're right now that I think of it. Here happens the same thing. God basically gives in. And the big question which we have to ask, which I want to leave with you, is may it be that there are some laws in the Torah which were given to Moshe or to us, where the whole point was that we should reject them. Where we should say, wait a moment, these are not moral laws. Perhaps you are just challenging us. Perhaps you are just trying us out. If we say, oh God, if you told us so, we better do so. Remember who said that? Noah. And Noah was told to go into the ark. He said, well, what says to go in the ark? And therefore, I'm not going to do anything, and I'm not going to argue with him about that. In the meantime, he's going to destroy all of mankind by way of this enormous flood. No, he is the, as they say in Yiddish, the tzaddik in pelts. You know, I'm the tzaddik, you know, I do whatever HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants me. That's not the Jewish way. The Jewish way is that when God comes to us and says to us, I want you to do this, and we don't like it, we say, God, very sorry, we won't do it. We just won't do it. And God says, wow, that's impressive. That's what I want to hear. This runs right through the whole of the rabbinic tradition. But the problem is that today we have lost some of it because we are overpowered and overwhelmed with just halakha for the sake of halakha without understanding what it means. I mentioned yesterday to Rabbi Kelman, I said to him, I very often say to my students, one of the problems with halakha is the art of making a problem out of every solution. In other words, what it is doing is, yes, it wants to get involved in every triviality because there are no trivialities in this world. Every little thing counts, like when you look under a microscope and you look into the microscope, the man behind the microscope is fascinated by what he sees over there. God is in the details, very true, and therefore all these little laws are of importance. But there are maybe moments there when you have forgotten about the big picture, and therefore you're going to go into a little detail, and you have misunderstood from where it all came, to see the larger picture, the beauty behind that. And if we lose out on that, we are violating the greatness of what halakha is all about. And therefore, it is incredibly important that whenever we go and look into halakha, we apply halakha, the first thing what we know is to go back to Sefer Bereshit. I just brought out a documentary, which is not yet available, but I said in there the following, which is the similar concept. I said, when a halachic authority starts paskening a very important she'ela, important question, you know what he should do? You first listen to Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven. First you listen to music. First you get the feeling like there is enormous amount of greatness in this world. And then after you have been picked up and you're living in this different world for a moment in the beautiful music of these people, whether it is Chazanut or it is Bach or Beethoven, doesn't matter, but you are taken into a different world, then when you have the large picture, you can make a psak din about a particular case, whether it is a mamzer or anything else. But if you sit in this little back, in this little box over there, and you're paskening from there, you're going to miss the point. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu give us the wisdom to use the halakha in the way as it was meant to be, and that is to glorify his greatness in this world. Thank you very much.
Will you be available for questions? Rabbi Dr. Lopez Cardozo will be available for questions for anybody who wants to stay. I have been told that some people may have Father's Day arrangements, so we're going to let the questions be after the thing. I just, on behalf of Zichron Yisrael Synagogue, we would like to thank you very much, Rabbi Dr. Lopez Cardozo, for addressing us and showing us of the importance of Musar TV, natural morality, and its intrinsic how it's hardwired into the halachic process, and we should all learn from poskim like Rav Unterman. We would also like to thank the Gutenberg and Kelman families for sponsoring this this lecture in our shul. It is, as usual, a kavod and a ta'anug, an honor and a pleasure, and we are so grateful for the involvement of the Kelman and Gutenberg families and Torah in Motion in grace in giving our shul such wonderful speakers over the years, and we can't tell you how much we appreciate you and love you.